Welcome to Board Game Binge, the place where we bring you bite-sized, bingeable board game content from across the industry. I'm your host, James Staley, and in this episode, we're chatting with Sebastian Bernier-Wong, wilderness guide and game designer of two pocket-sized two-player games, which are both currently on Kickstarter. Seb, welcome to the binge. How are you doing?
Hey there, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is fantastic having you. So let's just get the elephant in the room. We're both Canadian. Let's just get that out there. High five. It's always awesome talking to a Canadian on different sides of the country. Canada is very large for those who know Canada. You are on the West Coast and I'm kind of somewhat center of the country in Ontario near the Great Lakes. So it is always awesome to talk to a fellow Canuck. We're going to get into your game in a second, but really what attracted me to this when I saw the maple syrup, that iconic maple syrup imagery, any Canadian knows as soon as you see that, that it's usually the fall and it's maple syrup season. So I'm like, oh, I got to get this guy on the podcast. This is going to be awesome. So thank you so much for agreeing to come on. To start off with, the wilderness guide. So what is that? What do you do as a wilderness guide?
I used to do a lot more of it than I do now, but I would be taking folks out on canoe trips, on the river, just get them to gain a little bit of an appreciation for the land that we're on through spending time with it and just getting familiar with it.
Now, is this with like students or is this like people that sign up or how do you get these people kind of to guide?
For sure. I mean, it started out with youth and with students. I think like many people in the industry, I started out just, you know, working summer camp as a kid and then kind of as I grew up, started working with older groups and then eventually with adult clients, taking them out and kind of bigger and larger trips. But yeah.
And then how's the wildlife there? I know the island is, we call it the island. The island, it's a huge island, but there's a lot of wildlife there, right? Like, did you ever encounter like bears and things like this while you're canoeing or what?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. It's a very different kind of wildlife than where you are. But for us, we do have the bears. We do have all the coastal marine life.
Mountain lions as well. Like I heard that, like, I know it's more probably in the interior, but like, do you get any mountain lions like out in the island as well? Or
for sure. Yeah. I think the island might have like the highest density of cougars in North America, you know, as far as like land per amount of cougars goes. But they're elusive. If you're looking for them, you typically won't find them. And
if they
see you, you probably won't see them.
That's what they said. Yeah, if you see a cougar, it's too late. It's too late. It always scares the heck out of me when I see these like TikToks of people like walking a trail, usually West Coast Canada, and it's either a bear that's following them or, you know, they see a cat, you know, when they're on the bike and stuff like that. And you really got to kind of know and I guess be aware of your surroundings, but it really is quite safe, I guess, if you know what you're doing, isn't it?
I think the big thing is like we share the space, and if you don't like, if you're not going in with the fear of it, if you're just going about your day out there, they can pick up on that. I think it's the fear that becomes an issue, really. So.
And then how did you get into gaming? Like, is this something you've been doing your whole life or how long have you been board gaming for?
For sure. It's been something I've been engaged with my whole life. I've always enjoyed, I think, making games more than playing games, making little things for my brothers to try out. And kind of like, it's that little deconstructing games that I've been playing and then figuring out how can I make them the way I would like them to be.
It's almost like a homebrew kind of type thing, right?
Yeah. Been big into that.
Yeah, I often talk to people about that. That was really my first intro into gaming was Risk when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. My buddy and I would play Risk all the time, and then we just started homebrewing it. We put like nukes in it, so you could, if you got 100 army guys, you could cash them in for a nuke, and then you could like literally take out like the entire territory and all the connecting things around it. And you know, it's kind of like that dabbling with something that already exists. And as you say, kind of taking it apart, see how it works and kind of putting it back together and seeing how you can fix it. Then sometimes lead to some pretty cool game design. What was the first game you ever designed? Like, did you do small games when you're a kid, or when did you really start getting into kind of creating something truly kind of new?
I mean, lots of small games when I was a kid, lots of little pen and paper board games.
Yeah.
And then as I kind of got into high school and learned how to use a computer, I started making small flash games for a while. And I actually
Oh,
thought
wow.
I wanted to make video games.
Like
So I went
apps and things
to,
like that.
yeah, so that's kind of what I went to post-secondary to university for. But then I discovered board games through a game design class there. My game design professor had us all make board games, and I'd say that was one of the first like big games that I ever made. Started in that class
Yeah.
as a school project, which we eventually started workshopping and then brought to Kickstarter, or rather bought to a publisher who brought it to Kickstarter and
No kid. And
published it.
what was that
Yeah,
game?
it was called Sloops in the Class, but it's now published as Seas of Havoc by Rock Manor Games.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And then so this course in school, is that really for you what I said, okay, this is something that I can really sink my teeth into and do in a serious way.
I mean, getting the support from Peter, who was my professor, and then later we ended up co-designing the game and developing it. Getting the support from him and him saying, like, hey, this is really great. This is something we could actually turn into a real board game, like a marketable board game.
Yeah.
Just having somebody back that in that way was kind of what drove me to continue on with it.
It's amazing how powerful it is when someone, makes a comment like that, right? This is, hey, I think you got something here.
Totally.
And I think this is probably a moment that many people go through at some point who are in game design where, there's a lot of self-doubt or, you have this imposter syndrome. And sometimes it just takes that one person. And often I find this in these like pro spiels and things like that, where you can go and do play testing of your prototypes, where you have somebody saying, oh, I think you got something here. This is this th there, there's something here. And it might not be complete and the game might not be done, but there's a seed of something here that's got me kind of tantalized. And I want to see more of that. And just kind of having that nudge, I think, sometimes can push you along and get you like really diving in with both feet, right?
For sure. Yeah, it's huge. I mean, that's getting that feedback, even from just people testing and playing the games at an early age. That was what kept me going with it. It's like I wanted to create something for people to enjoy and then kind of hear what they thought about it and then use that to kind of fuel the next piece, the next development for it.
There's no greater feeling than seeing somebody enjoy something that you've created. And I know this is consistent when talking with literally any designer at all. It's almost like a drug. Like this is like a you get a rush from it, right? When you see people. I remember the first time I had you're obviously trying to get people to play your games and anybody and anyone you can get to play it. But the first time I was at a meetup event. We do these in Ontario. We have these board game meetups, which are open to the public. And I was at a table and looked over and I saw a table across the room and they had pulled out a game that I had made. So I did, it
No
is
way.
the first time I actually saw somebody pull out a game that I didn't ask them to play, that I didn't say, hey guys, can you play my game? On their own, they played it. And I just like, it just hit me. Like
That's huge.
I
Yeah.
got my phone out. I actually took a picture. I'm like, I gotta get this. I gotta capture this moment. Like just so I don't forget. Why we do this, right? And the excitement around it and so much joy that it creates. For you, I noticed that and we're gonna get into these games in a second, but they're both pocket-sized games. So what was the idea? I imagine kind of being out in the wilderness and traveling light. Is that kind of what led to these pocket-sized games, or what kind of led you down that path?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. That whole experience of being able to share a game with somebody is something we wanted to actually take out in the spaces that I spend a lot of time in. When I started Firestarter Games with Dan, like we both do the same thing. We both work outside with people, and we both enjoy games. We wanted whatever we created to be something we could actually take where we go and
Yeah.
where we end up meeting people the most. So.
Are they waterproof?
There
Maybe not
actually
yet, right? Oh, was
there
it?
was a an early version of Downstream. We had about 50 copies of these and we sold them out to friends. It was completely waterproof. The cards were plastic, and
oh, that's awesome.
You could, yeah, lay them out. It was lovely, but not anymore. Not everybody needs plastic cards, and we don't need to create.
And then why two player games? So I get the small size, so it's easy to travel, and especially when you're you know, guiding and backpacking and so forth. But I noticed both of them are for two players. So what was the decision process there?
It just felt like a nice small design constraint to stay within. And honestly, it's also a lot easier to test when we don't live in big cities. We have a very small pool of play testers to draw from.
Yeah.
And in we usually are just playing games with one other person here. So two player games kind of felt like it was just natural, fell into place.
And then I'm showing on screen for those who are watching either live or on the replay. So first of all, congrats on your funding so far. I'm going to put this in Canadian dollars because it's the only way you and I can see it. Mm-hmm. It's you're at $31,500 on $8,000 goal, 6 days to go. We're talking just before we went on air. It's probably going to hit 40 grand. So congrats on that. That's amazing. That's a really nice size campaign for a small game. I'm going to talk about these kind of individually, but walk me through kind of the inspiration for the two different themes you have here. And are they very different games, or how are they similar and how are they different?
Sure. Yeah. I'd say they're two very different games. Downstream is a card laying game where you're playing cards to essentially build out a river. Each card you play has a piece of the river and then you're adding it on. And then Masters of Maple Syrup, that's just it's like an action selection game. You're choosing something to do. You and your neighbor both get to do it. You just kind of get a bit of a benefit when you choose your action. How do they come about though? Downstream is the first game that Dan and I made together. We were kind of just throwing around ideas for what theme we wanted our game mm-hmm. to be around. And then we figured we'd come up with the design afterwards. We're both big on whitewater paddling, and it just kind of, we had a lot of other ideas, but naturally we just gravitated towards the thing that brought us together. So from there, we just both came up with different ideas, would compare and contrast and kind of like pull the best parts of each of our prototypes, and then continued refining and refining. We had maybe five different variations of the game, and then eventually came down to what we have right now.
So Downstream, what you have on screen here, looks super cool. Congrats. Thanks. I mean, I just asked you right literally before we went live. I'm like, hey, who did your graphic design? Looks awesome. And you're like, oh, I did that. I'm like, wow. Good job. It looks awesome. So walk me through how this Downstream works. This looks really, really interesting. So you've got this kind of stream with the cards. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does each player kind of compete in this?
So in this, yeah, you have a deck of cards. Each of them have that separate piece of the river. You're adding them one another to an end, to the end.
Yeah.
But each player represents one side of the water. And on either side of the river, there are these different symbols. They could be wildlife symbols or campsite symbols, mountains or forests. And you're trying to arrange these symbols along your river in certain patterns. There's these objective cards that you're choosing five of at the start of the game, and they kind of determine how you want to place things. So maybe you want to put mountains next to other mountains, or you want to keep your campsites away from wildlife. You're kind of just choosing different random goals at the start of the game and then trying to play them out as you build the river.
And then how does the score? So you got this boat. So there's a boat on the river. Mm-hmm. Is it moving like every round the boat moves one more spot down the river, or how's that work?
So the deck of cards, those river cards, you can choose to draw from the top or the bottom of that deck. If you choose to flip the deck over and then draw from the bottom, you're moving the canoe forwards, and it just limits where you can put cards. You can only place things
in front of
where the canoe is or downstream of it. Exactly. The journey still to come, not what was behind.
And then is it end? I guess it ends when the canoe gets to the end of the river. That just basically triggers the end of the game and you score.
Yeah, the game ends once you've played the whole deck of cards out.
Oh, you go through the whole deck. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
And the canoe just kind of keeps things moving along. Otherwise, you got way too much data to try to process in your head.
And are these domino cards or what kind of cards are these? I'm looking at the video here. They're like
They're roughly the shape of a business card, actually. Yeah.
Gotcha. Oh, it looks super cool. Oh my gosh. I think I'm going to be a backer of this. All right. So, and then
Well,
talk to me
thank
about
you.
maple syrup. Obviously, us both being Canadian, this is like just part of our culture, right? But what, other than being Canadian, what got you kind of in this direction of the maple syrup and creating a game around it? And
For
what does the
sure.
game do? Like, what are you doing in this game?
Yeah, I mean, in this game, you're two neighbors, two rival sugar bushes, and you're just essentially building out your property, trying to become the best producer of maple syrup in the province. This game came about when I was guiding in Ontario in Algonquin Park,
Oh, nice.
and kind of was starved for being able to meet people outside of work. So a friend connected me with her mother, who owned a maple, I mean a sugar bush, a maple tree farm, and also a little apiary. And she gave me a tour, and it was just delightful. It was
Yeah,
really,
it's cool.
really awesome to get to see. So that was kind of the inspiration there. I learned a lot from her. And then, yeah. Got home back to BC eventually when the whole pandemic happened. This was just a little project to kind of keep my mind busy. It started as just building a little 18 card game for me and my partner to play.
Yeah.
And then just kind of ended up growing and growing from there to a 36 card game. And then now it's 55, 54. But yeah, it was a project that it started really small and intimate, and people just ended up loving it and wanted to share it with others.
So you're trying to be the best maple syrup producer, I guess. And I can see like there's values. So are you actually selling your syrup in this game at all, or is it more kind of like, because I can see you got like a tap, a harvest, and a develop card. So is there stages like that where you're like, okay, we're gonna plant, then we're gonna harvest, then we're gonna tap? Like, how does that sequence work?
It plays very loosely with the how an actual season might run for producing maple syrup, but essentially that's it. You're choosing to either tap your trees to harvest from them, and then that boil, and then boiling that syrup, and then you can spend cards that you've drawn from harvesting
Yeah.
to then develop other things onto your property. So very loose, I suppose, with the theming. It's kind of,
The branding is or more the design is quite clever. Because you have the instant recognition. Was that something out of the gate that you're like, I gotta make sure this kind of matches what I see on shelf when I'm in a typical grocery store in the fall here in Canada? Or like, how did you kind of land on the final design?
Yeah, wanted to match the feel of, I guess, maple syrup from what I'd known from back from at home. And then it was, yeah, lots of inspirations to draw from, lots of different cans of maple syrup that I got to check out, and then just
Yeah.
kind of drew the elements that, yeah, worked the most for me, or that reminded me the most of maple syrup.
It's one of the best things I find, especially for kids, to take kids during maple syrup season, right? To kind of see the whole process and how much of the raw kind of liquid that comes out of the tree to render down into actual syrup like is needed. Like, it is staggering how much you have to collect just to get a little bottle of syrup. And kids can then pour it in the snow and make like the little syrup
Maple
on a
taffy.
stick and the treats and things like that. Like, it really is I would say a cultural part of growing up here in Canada, especially in, I'd say, Eastern Canada, like Ontario and Quebec, right? Yeah.
That's where my mom's from. She's from Quebec, and so she brought that love of maple syrup over to us as well.
Oh, that's nice. Now, this isn't your first campaign. This is your second campaign. You did another campaign before this. What was that? What was that game?
Yeah, that game was Reforest. That was a game I designed and then had a friend, Janine Van Fram, do art for. The whole idea with it was I wanted to create a game that I like feel proud about sharing with others, and that could hopefully teach people about the space that they lived in.
Yeah.
So its full name is Reforest Plants of the Pacific Northwest Coast. You're building out a forest from nothing. For whatever reason, this land has been cleared out. And your goal in the game is to play these different plants in a natural forest succession. So you're choosing small little herbs and shrubs to play down first, and eventually you're growing into larger trees. And each of these plants affect each other. They all have these little powers to help you grow that ecosystem.
That's cool. And then how did that campaign do for you?
Well, that one did great. I mean, that was the first one I did, and it was very successful. It's still, like, the games are on the ship. They're on their way over right now and should be here at the end of the month. So I'll be able to tell you a lot more in a month's time when I actually get to ship it out to everybody. But the feedback and the kind of advanced copies that I've been able to get people have really been successful in as a game, but also in educating people about all of these different plant species. Yeah.
And what were some of the learnings that you took from that campaign into this one? Was there anything that you're like, okay, I got to make sure I do that? Or was there anything where you're like, ah, I cannot repeat that same mistake?
So much. Countless things. Mostly just the process, you know, how to go from designing the game. I had like a good amount of experience in designing games at this point, but how to actually market it and then bring it onto Kickstarter and then draw people to that crowdfunding campaign. Sorting out the shipping and all these other little things about importing games into Canada.
Yeah.
There's so many details, as you already know. But it's been nice to be a part of it, and certainly makes it simpler to do your second one after that.
And where did you go, like, for your research to learn that? Because, you know, obviously it might not be obvious to other people, but I mean, Kickstarter is it seems like it probably must be intuitive, but it's not, right? There's a lot of stuff in there. You're like, ooh, this is like a different kind of platform. How did you go about researching for that to figure out how to structure your pages and really how to approach it?
Sure. I think parallel to designing games, I was also just listening to a lot of podcasts, taking in a lot of, you know, Board Game Design Lab, Ludology, necessarily all about publishing, but you're getting these designers and these publishers come on and they're just sharing little tidbits of wisdom. And, you know, you take a listen to one of these on a walk every now and again, and you're just like building up a picture of what to expect at the very least.
Yeah.
So I kind of figured I knew what to expect when going into Reforest. Lots of little details that I knew like would come, but that they wouldn't be surprises that I'd be spending a certain amount of time or that these surprises would even come up. It was just really helpful to hear other people's experiences and then kind of know broadly where to go on the internet to like fill in the gaps and the details.
Yeah. I would say that research is so important before you start. You know, when I look at kind of, I go back a few years back and I talked to a lot of first time, you know, publishers at that point, and I was surprised how many would be like, I was browsing Kickstarter and I found a game kind of like mine, and you know, I saw that one did 100,000. So I thought I'd be conservative and I just picked 20,000 as my goal and, you know, try to do some of the similar things they did. And it is important to look at how other pages are structured. And I think that the ones that fund high have a very different structure than the ones that fund a low, right? And so there's a lot of learnings there. But I like what you said about like listening to different sources, whether it be a podcast or going on websites. I mean, Jamie Stagmeyer's got,
totally,
you know, on StonemeyerGames.com, there is literally an encyclopedia on, you know, publishing games there, and, you know, blogs he's constantly writing on, things to consider when, you know, when you, anything from design all the way through. We're talking before we went on air, Crowdfunded. It was the other one, right? Launchboom.com. Mm-hmm. Literally on their site, they have paint by numbers of here's how you launch a campaign. So what I like about podcasts like, you know, Board Game Design Lab or even Crowdfunding Nerds and these guys is hearing the stories behind it, right? Because it's not just, hey, I'm going to kind of try to mimic what this page did, but you're not getting the struggles. from just looking at a page, right? You're not getting the story behind that. You literally need to hear people's stories of what were some of the issues they ran into. What are some of the things they assumed that just blew up in their face, right? There's so much learning there that you're missing out on if you're not doing that. I mean, if somebody's listening to this podcast, obviously they're listening to podcasts, so they're probably on the right path. But for those that are looking for advice, you know, that's something I say is you know, just listen to as many different sources as you possibly can and grab inspiration from it. Because if you can learn from other people's mistakes, then you have a chance of not making those same mistakes yourself. I mean, there's a good chance you still might make those mistakes, because often human nature is we don't learn from others, and we sometimes have to learn the hard lessons ourselves. But if you can learn the hard lesson and let someone else use their resources for you to learn that lesson, that's always going to be better for you, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
So we're like, you obviously have got this company now. This is 3 games now, so 2 campaigns. What is the plan? Like, are you like full steam ahead on game design to the next path, or kind of what comes after this one?
Keeping it kind of controlled. I mean, still working the day job and it takes up a lot of time.
Yeah.
Got a lot of game design, like game ideas that I would love to pull out. And right now my focus is just on delivering these 3 games, getting them out to people, and then learning that part, the fulfillment. Yeah. We're like, they're small games. I'm keeping them all in this tiny little cabin where I live and mailing them out to people from here. There's going to be a lot of learning. So I want to focus on that first. And then once that's kind of under control, then I can start working on other games and bringing those out into the world.
Do you have some kind of in the hopper, at least from a design perspective, where you're thinking, okay, this will be the one that'll be next up? Or?
Oh yeah. I'd love to do a game about where, like, once a salmon is just rotting on the shores, where do all of its nutrients go and who are pulling those nutrients?
Bears.
I feel like that'd be a great, that's one of them for sure. Yeah, I think I'd like to work on games that continue, just like Reforest, to teach people about whatever topic it is they're about, and maybe try to go for topics that aren't usually in games.
So definitely nature theme though still, or?
Yeah, nature or outdoor recreation or anything that feels like it's worth sharing and that could benefit us all.
Yeah. I think it's great that you're trying to figure out go fully through the experience of the fulfillment side before you get into your next one. That is a beast, right? And probably the scariest part from my perspective of the entire process is the fulfillment side, because there's so many ways that can blow up in your face and cost you a boatload of money. It's not even funny. And so, you know, after 6 campaigns, it still scares me. Right. And so I, you know, if it doesn't scare people, then they need to get scared, because because if you don't approach it right, you're not going to be prepared, and you can make some pretty, pretty costly mistakes. And quite frankly, we want backers to get their games when we promise to get it to them. Right. I think we all have an example of being backers ourselves of campaigns that, you know, I saw another one the other day, great game, not going to say what it is, but it was 2 years late. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I get it if it's a couple of weeks, but 2 years late was it kind of sucks, right? So I think if we can all continue to fulfill our games on time, that'll improve the consumer confidence around it and keep people in the platform and kind of keep this engine going. Yeah. For those who want to check out these 2 games, as I said, I think I'm probably going to back these myself after this episode's done. They look super cool. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. People can simply go there. If you search for it on Kickstarter, type in Masters of Maple, and that will get you the campaigns will pop up, and you'll easily be able to find them. If people want to follow you on social media, how best do they do that?
Yeah. Well, on Facebook, we're Firestarter Board Games, and then Instagram, it's Firestarter Games. Those be the two.
Awesome. Well, Seb, I want to wish you all the best on this campaign. I can't wait to see how it ends up. I'm going to be rooting for you, and I wish you all the best in your fulfillment in this coming year.
Right on. Much appreciated. Thanks, James.
No worries. You take care. Cheers.
You too. Bye.
This has been an episode of the Board Game Binge Podcast, hosted by James Staley, produced by James Staley and Mike Bruner, with original music by Nick Smith.
If you would like to watch these interviews live, simply subscribe to our YouTube channel, Board Game Binge, and you'll get access to live interviews, giveaways, and interesting board game content from across the industry. I can't wait for you to join us. See you next time.